Hello and welcome to episode 74 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
We have no cookie this week, but that's cool because we are joined by Jack Hackett of Cornwall-based Antimatter Games, which is a new game studio formed from the team who made the critically regarded Rising Storm standalone expansion for Red Orchestra 2, which PC Gamer recently named their multiplayer game of the year, beating Battlefield 4.
To my surprise, hi everyone.
So we've got lots up for discussion this week. So what have we got going, Paul?
Yeah, we've got Tarantino reacts to script leak by stopping production of The Hateful Eight. EA and Microsoft involved in paying for positive YouTube coverage. Channel 5 to stop airing The Walking Dead. The saga of Candy and Saga and the King. Yeah. We'll get to that one in a second. Lastly, we're going to be talking with Jack about games and his PhD.
So, yeah, that Tarantino story. So just before we start recording tonight, we hopped online, and it evolved since writing out our show outline for this episode. But originally, Tarantino kind of, like, gave the script to a few people, The Hateful Eight, to look at, and either an actor or an agent decided to leak details of said script.
Because he's an arse.
And then somehow Gawker managed to get a whole load of URLs for people to download it from somewhere.
Isn't that today. A little bit naughty?
It's just a bit naughty. Apparently Tarantino was pretty pissed off by what happened last week, because the whole sort of betrayal thing in general happened last week. And he was feeling really angry about it. He had some very harsh words to say on Deadline. And he was going to, just publish it as a book for the time being. But goodness knows now when this film may see the light of day as a film, because Tarantino is now suing Gawker for leaking the script. And
it's an incredibly selfish thing for Gawker to do, I think, because mostly I look at the story and think, now I don't get a cool new Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
And I'm just angry with Gawker, but they'll get loads of hits, which is why they did it, really, isn't it? I mean,
it's a horrible thing to do with the, we're not going to get the film, so we'll just helpfully make the entire situation worse. Instead of just saying, if they really wanted to, they could have just said, it's out there, but we're not going to tell you where.
Oh, this goes. Yeah, it goes beyond coverage and directly into I don't know what the legal.
It's enabling. It's directly going against what Tarantino wanted and just saying there you go.
Well, I mean, technically, a script's still a copyrighted piece of material. I mean, when I try to source scripts for sort of like research purposes, I try to make sure I get them from reputable sources. For instance, I have a book version of all the Dark Knight trilogy films. It's like a proper, actual Fab and Faber published book. Trying to do things like that. Or I've got like the book script for like Juno as well. Things like that. It's good when you source things, but it's when it's something that, A, obviously the writer, let alone any studios, have agreed to being put out there. And it wasn't even produced yet.
No, whether Gawker can get away with... Because I think if you go to the Gawker page, they sort of let you click away to some kind of anonymous file hosting thing. So Gawker may be able to kind of hand wave it away and say it's not their kind of crime to report that it's out there and this is where you can get it. But I think they're doing it with the intent of getting a lot of click-throughs.
To be honest, though, if something slightly similar but more drastic, we've had sites in the last year or so that have linked to illegal TV show and film-watching sources. They've been done for linking. So there is precedent for
just saying that we've given a link is no defence legally, because you would just get your ass kicked.
Yeah. But I'm just kind of annoyed because, I mean, I've liked Tarantino's films for quite a while, and the idea that basically what could have been an interesting Western isn't going to be out there, it's annoying, I need something after Django Unchained. You know, I need another bloody violent Tarantino film.
I mean, who doesn't need another bloody violent Tarantino film?
I know, there's never probably going to be, you know, enough of them, but to deny the making of one that had a script is just...
And Tarantino's a very accessible, creative person who kind of puts himself out there, and I think for him to kind of get treated almost like a faceless corporation like this by kind of anonymous people is very, very disappointing. It's not the way you want someone to be treated when they're kind of... Yeah, he's a creative filmmaker. You know,
yeah, he is a film head, isn't he? He is very much in the, you know, I'm part of this thing because I like doing this kind of thing. So it's just disappointing.
This is why things like laws about this kind of thing have to exist, because people will even treat good people like Quentin Tarantino this way. And that's really disappointing, isn't it?
If I remember correctly, a early draft of Inglourious Basterds did make its way online, typos and all. For the title, and he was pissed then, but I assume it was the fact that he'd like only recently given it out to some people to look at, and the fact that, because it wasn't just the fact that the people got told about the details, it was the fact that people got told the details and he was being rung for people, either actors or agents, pitching themselves or their clients for roles from the script. So, you know, and I think it was a first draft, or, you know, it was an early draft as well, so it wasn't complete. And it's just like, it's just the whole thing's just been spilled.
On a very personal level, someone must have really betrayed him. I mean,
yeah,
it clearly went around very quickly, which is why I think he's so sore about it. And understandably so, because, yeah, if you give a script to a handful of people you think you can trust with it enough to not... I mean, if you get a kind of proper production script through, it'll have a watermark, which clearly identifies it as yours, kind of on every page in like light gray text usually.
Yeah.
And obviously he didn't bother to do that here because he gave it to people he trusted enough that he didn't think that kind of was necessary. He must be very frustrated now.
I hate to think if it's going to be a case of like spotting, if it ever got out, or even his next film after that, just spotting out of his regulars in front and behind the camera who don't appear, and they're going, oh, you know, were they the individual responsible for getting this out there?
I wonder if he knows now who it was, or whether it's still unclear.
I'd bloody hope so, because he strikes me as the kind of person who would make sure that, you know, something's identifiable, unless, as you say, it's a very small group of people that, you know, really close friends and family that you trust. But I've been in a few situations where, you know, there's been a beta of software, or, you know, just something like, you know, site access, things like that, with the, you know, you don't even say that it's there.
Yeah.
And I've seen other people, you know, and they've said, I've only given this out to, you know, like, say, you know, 10 people, and it leaks. And everyone involved is pissed the hell off when that happens, because it's a, you know, you've been trusted with this, and someone has, you know, almost by association made you look bad.
And it really undermines the creative process as well, because it's the same in games. If you're all working on something, you're all kind of under this obligation not to tell people about it, and you're working with these people closely on an idea every day, and you only share it with those people. And then if it gets out, you're going to be... Especially if it gets out because of one of them, suddenly, if you don't know who it was, but you know someone let you down, it kind of undermines that collaboration. And I think he probably feels like that right now, would be my guess.
It does. I would say that's why he's so incredibly pissed off about it. Not that he wanted to keep it secret, like I've seen, you know, people say, oh, well, if he didn't want to keep it secret, he shouldn't have given it out to anyone. So, no, that's not the point. Someone has given this thing away that he trusted.
The thing is, because it was mooted in one article that it would be 5 years before he'd revisit the concept now for The Hateful Eight. What is he going to do then in this interim period?
He's probably been completely thrown gravely in terms of what he's going to do next. He must have been really excited by the script if he was handing it out to people kind of informally and giving it to particular actors he thought would be good in it. So you've got to assume that he's going to be frustrated creatively at least for a while, which again is a selfish thing that the people... Both, you know, that initially did it, and now people like Gorka who are kind of exacerbating the problem.
I'd like to think it's someone's friend or other half or family who's done it and not someone he's given it to directly. You know, it doesn't excuse that it got out, but I'd like it to not be something so direct.
Yeah, at least then it's a stupid person, not
yeah.
someone who's personally betrayed him. It'll be easier yeah. to move past that, I would imagine. You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna move us on now to our next story, which seemed to just confirm things that probably people suspected was kind of going on at varying levels and degrees within the games video community or games journalism community. I mean, after
is that journalism in air quotes?
Yeah, you'd think after Doritos Gate and so forth that people would know not to encourage this kind of thing, but basically, I first learned about this from Ars Technica last week, and that was basically the situation that YouTubers, as in people who make YouTube gaming videos on for the Mac, I can't pronounce their name, Machinima?
Machinima, I think.
Machinima Network?
Machinima?
Had been...
I say Machinima, but... Yeah.
They've been paid to say nice things about Xbox One in their videos, essentially.
Not even been paid very much either.
No.
I mean, the total budget was minuscule.
But it was the fact that they had to
really
say...
It's really pathetic.
It's the fact that they had to say... The qualifying things were kind of dodgy. It was like, was it to qualify for the campaign and the extra payments, Machinima partners had to post a video including at least 30 seconds of Xbox One game footage that mentioned the Xbox One by name and included the tag XB1M13.
Which is actually quite interesting. It's Xbox One or Microsoft actually actively trying to get Xbox One footage onto YouTube rather than, you know, off it.
Yeah. And then, but then according to us, the legal agreement that went with people who were like agreeing to do this and were participating, it said that that creators may not say negative or disparaging things about Machinima, Xbox One, or any of its games, and that they had to keep details of the promotional agreement confidential in order to qualify, which, as some people have said, apparently goes against bits of FTC regulation, and to be honest, over here it probably would go against stuff from the what are they called again? Is it FSA?
It's extremely dubious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really
extraordinarily dodgy.
Yeah, and I find it depressing. This is the thing about it. I mean, the total budget, according to one of the emails, was $3,750, and people got an extra $3 per 1,000 video views on their videos.
Yeah,
and that. So I mean, it's quite depressing that people were willing to do such an unscrupulously, an obviously unscrupulous thing for quite a small amount of money. But me think that this kind of thing happens quite a lot, which depresses me.
Yeah, if anyone thought it was like a valid marketing tactic, and they're stumping up that degree of money for it, and like then obviously I kind of feel a bit sorry for the people making the videos because they think it's actually worth ruining their integrity for such little money.
Integrity?
Yeah.
Have you seen some of these videos?
I know, and we've talked about some creators of said videos before, but.
I've watched, you know, I haven't searched specifically for these, but, you know, I've seen videos by people who, you know, they have quite a lot of subscribers and the videos have quite a lot of views. And I'm just sitting there thinking, you're an idiot who talks shit. You don't know anything about what you're talking about. Jesus Christ, this is depressing.
I think the strange thing about YouTube and kind of everyone being able to put content up is that sometimes people can make that kind of content and other people want to see it, and they get a kind of following without any kind of preparation for what that might entail, so they'll go along with this kind of thing. Machinima's had a lot of kind of strange controversy lately as well with how much they support their affiliates with things like copyright infringement and how much they take as a kind of cut for what they give to their contributors. So this doesn't really surprise me that it's going through their network.
I mean, just to be clear with this, the whole, you know, Machinima, which that's how I'm saying it. I don't care if it's
we'll all go
the right
for
way
our
or not.
Interpretation.
Yeah, it's a performance art, how you say it. to me, that, you know, the whole point is things like you know, Red versus Blue as a series, you know, creating films with a game.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the Machinima Network on YouTube now has gone quite a long way beyond the original meaning of the word.
Yeah,
And they are now essentially just a sort of Let's Play network for the most part. But they take lots and lots of different kinds of game footage under their umbrella and provide support in exchange for a cut of all the advertising profits from the videos.
Yeah, because I have seen a few people be a little bit confused with what they're, you know, they're paying, you know, people to try and ape Red versus Blue or something. It's like, no, that's not that. It's basically paying for someone to sit there and say, I have played this game on Xbox One. It is awesome. Xbox One is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Eat bag of Doritos. Drink Mountain Dew.
Double XP.
Yeah, and turn round to Windows 8 tablet and Porot screen. Mm-hmm. You know that, and go, this is an awesome works experience. It's brilliant and it's utterly great. It's what I want on the desktop computer.
And apparently EA have perhaps been engaged in similar activities with YouTubers regarding such games as Battlefield 4, which I suppose needs somebody saying good things about it, because whenever I hear anything about Battlefield 4, it's about the situation with multiplayer online.
Oh, the servers are down, the servers don't work, the share button on the PS4 doesn't work or something.
Yeah.
I think, to be fair... I think, to be fair, if there's two companies in the entirety of the gaming industry that you think would be just after money, literally just after money, I would actually put it on Microsoft and EA.
Yeah.
So it's not that surprising that these two companies specifically were doing this.
I mean, the only positive I'm taking from all of this is that they are actually interested in people, you know, putting game footage up instead of some other, you know, companies, and, you know, both hardware and software, you know, are companies that, you know, go after people who put up game footage.
That reminds me, you know how Terry Kavanagh basically had his game VVVV, the footage of it pulled from YouTube because of copyright infringement?
Which is incredibly stupid.
Yeah, well, he appealed the decision and got rejected. So it still is not.
And this was based off of the whole fact that whatever company he used, I think, to license the music for the game is the one that's objecting, essentially, through the automated processes involved. And it's like, it's his fucking game. It's his music at the end of, you know, it's just crazy.
That's insane. And VV.
Six V's.
It's a brilliant game based on the Commodore 64, by the way, to anyone out there. Not the NES. I know I've said it before, but it bears repeating.
Not the NES? I didn't even think it was. NES.
No, well, based people see 8-bitty and automatically think NES, and he's like, no, it's Commodore 64, which
It always struck me as older than NES style.
Yeah. I mean, the Commodore 64 could do better than that, but it's just, you know, that's apparently what he grew up with. And that's what he did. You know, down to the screen font, for God's sake. So, yeah, but it's idiotic that he's had it pulled. I've seen a few people say, you know, get in touch with me if you put up, you know, footage of my game and it gets pulled, please get in touch with me and, you know, we'll see what we can get sorted. But I find it amazing he's been rejected.
Yeah. He tweeted that this evening, so
I missed that.
We can look forward to a lot more of this kind of story, the copyright infringement, though, now with the lovely, here in Britain at least, with our lovely new internet filters, which thankfully you can obviously turn off, but still, I mean, there was a story today about how one of the largest JavaScript databases online is blocked by the new internet filters. Good job.
It's obviously sexy jobs.
Oh, it probably just features the letters S, E, and X.
And of course, the whole thing with the League of Legends.
Yeah,
Because some people were theorizing that some of the file names, in amongst the name, had SEX.
Hmm.
Yeah, I can't even begin. I mean, like, just to think about how much of a problem that would cause if it happened to our studio with a Rising Storm update. they must be furious. And but at least they're a big enough company that they can kind of take the impracticality of sorting out that customer service nightmare that that probably is to help all those people get their game sorted around some arbitrary filter. But a smaller studio like ours would be crippled by that if we had to try and solve that technical problem suddenly because half the people in Britain couldn't play Rising Storm when they wanted to. It would be really nightmarish.
I imagine that this is the reason why there are no software developers in Scunthorpe.
Amongst other reasons.
Amongst several other reasons, so, I'd say,
there's
yes.
A, there's a reason we're based in Cornwall. It's nice here most of the time.
Or thinking about it, there aren't any local software developers, as far as I know, in Cockermouth.
Actually, I do wonder if even being in a place like Come to Good...
Cumbria! Oh, Jesus. Cockermouth in Cumbria. I mean, Jesus, that's just like a double whammy of internet filter fail there.
I'm going to move on to our next story about Channel 5, who are to stop airing The Walking Dead on UK tellies because they hate us. They instead decide to treat us with newly launched, slightly untested sci-fi shows instead of stuff that's been proven to at least be gripping and disgusting.
Well, when you say newly launched and untested, you also forgot unimaginative.
Oh, that's a good point.
That they always
is crap. Another
We haven't actually seen them, but we've heard of them, and their premises sound just so cliche.
Well, which one sounded? Was it Helix? Sounded like Fringe. I can't remember now. Something my parents were describing the shows they're suddenly watching on Channel 5 to us, which was alarming in the least. I think it's just because a load of CSI stuff's ended and they were just looking for other things to watch and these things just happened to come along. But one show sounded like it had the premise of Fringe and I was just like, I said, that sounds like Fringe. And they were like, what? And I was like,
And I go, aha, that's why you're watching it, because you've not seen Fringe.
Yeah, and I mean, I just about coped with Fringe once I started watching it because obviously I'm quite a
Fringe was awesome.
Because I'm quite a dyed-in-the-wool X-Files fan, so
Fringe had the massive advantage that it didn't have David Duchovny in.
Clearly you've not seen that. Is it the opening episode of series 2? Clearly you've not seen that. You would not be saying that if you'd seen that episode.
What, in the speedos?
Yeah, you'd totally not be saying that in those red speedos.
Yeah,
I can see the drool, Emily. I can see the drool.
I'm so far away from understanding the red speedo situation. I never saw Fringe. That's terrible. And I don't watch The Walking Dead either. Can you watch anywhere?
Get out.
The Walking Dead can be watched if you wish to sell your soul to Sky.
Is it still on Sky?
It's still on Sky. And it's like, I don't want, there's a reason why I've been avoiding signing up to Sky. And it's not because I can't afford it. It's because I have ethical qualms.
Yeah, I can understand your issues. I mean, it's extremely frustrating. I mean, I don't own a television. I watch TV online, but I mean, if I wanted to watch Game of Thrones on Sky at my own home, the cost of getting a TV license, a TV, a Sky installation, and a Sky contract for 18 months is so astronomical that I just can't. I mean, Game of Thrones is good, but not that good. I'll just go to my friend's house. That's my solution.
I mean, I've read the books, so they don't actually have many surprises for me. But I'm waiting for HBO to get round to its DVD release season, which happens next month, and finally pick up season 3 of Game of Thrones.
Oh, you're in for a treat.
It's a very well. You've got to admit, it's a very well done adaptation. Mm. I think I like watching it live because it's. It's fun to see how they do it. You know?
I think one of the things that, I mean, because obviously Walking Dead is Showtime in the US, is it? Is it Showtime or is it AMC that makes
AMC.
It?
AMC.
AMC.
AMC makes it, sorry, who was quite small.
Dexter and Californication.
Showtime. Yeah, sorry, so Walking Dead is AMC. But they don't have any exclusivity contracts for the whole lot of their content with Sky. Meanwhile, HBO obviously signed that deal with Sky several years ago, where it was like, oh, all of their stuff is going to go on Sky Atlantic.
Yeah, and they are now doing an impression of Scrooge McDuck in his vault.
Yeah, but the frustrating thing being that prior to that deal, HBO stuff had been on a variety of channels, namely places like Channel 4. Like the only reason Pardon?
And BBC 4. Yeah. Oh, no, hang on. Mad Men wasn't HBO, is it?
No. It's Boardwalk Empire is.
Yeah, but I'm thinking BBC 4 were showing Mad Men, which was a prestigious series.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, actually, no, even though it's moved to Sky Atlantic.
Yeah, Mad Men is also AMC, I think.
Yeah.
Walking Dead's on the Fox channel over here.
It is Fox now.
It's Fox now.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was so disorientated when they put that O. I just didn't know what the world meant anymore.
I was a bit upset because I hadn't previously realized it was Fox. I'd rather they would have kept it FX and I could have stayed in the dark about its kind of corporate overlords. Now I know I can't enjoy it as much. I liked FX.
I do feel that the legal ruling over the News Corp empire that happened the other year perhaps wasn't stringent enough in how to split up things. Meanwhile, there was that lovely point where I can't remember if it was during a meeting for the actual News Corp that actually deals with the news or to do with Sky or something, and there was like a board meeting last year about, oh, shall we stop having like various Murdoch's heads of things? And that didn't happen. So, yeah. But anyway, going back to The Walking Dead, I mean, it's annoying because it would, I suppose, hopefully it means that the DVD release would be pushed up a bit. Because the problem with previously with it on Channel 4, because they had it so much later after Fox Channel, the DVD release dates over here were getting a bit ridiculous because they had to finish airing before they'd entirely before they'd release DVDs and Blu-rays. So maybe we'll get it sooner in one way than if it was still on Channel 5. But I'm hoping. That's what I'm hoping for.
Well, part of the problem is the age old, they buy something good and then they stick it on at random times or in a random order and whatnot and basically wonder why the viewing figures plummet.
Yeah, that's what
a bit like what happened with Firefly as well.
Yeah, I mean,
it's when you have people in charge of a channel or some, you know, or an organization who don't like the genre. That's my take a lot of the time. No, they'll look at something and say, "Ah, it's sci-fi, or it's this or that," so it won't be that popular, so we'll put it on at a dead time.
And it seems likely that, I mean, we can talk about DVD sales, but not to condone it. Realistically, most of the people who watch on Channel 5 are now going to pirate it.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Screw you, I'm off to,
Because if you don't treat them right, if you don't treat a kind of consumer with some respect, then they're going to go and just take it because you don't treat them nicely, they won't treat you nicely. And it annoys me because it's going to lead to more habitual piracy. If you always pirate The Walking Dead because you can't watch it and you always pirate Game of Thrones because you can't watch it, you're more inclined to pirate a game someone makes that you can buy online because you're on the Pirate Bay all the time anyway. This is the kind of stuff which all kind of serves to make piracy more common, and it frustrates me a lot.
This is the whole problem which anime companies had to learn this. Years ago, when they'd wait ages for the price to come down for a series before they bought it for release in the West, but the fan subbers would leap on something that you know they'd get it as soon as they could, put their subtitles on it, translate it, put their subtitles on it, even down to sound effects in intro songs and things like that, and do karaoke bloody versions, all of that kind of thing, and put it out. And the anime companies learned that if they were going to make any money out of stuff, they had to not only up the game of what they were doing, but release far sooner.
Yeah.
And that brought things forward. And it's like Kevin Spacey saying about doing
House of Cards.
House of Cards for Netflix. And the whole idea of you put all the episodes up all at once. And he says, if you actually do something in a way that, punters want, they will be willing to pay for it.
Well, it's very hard to justify, for anyone to justify pirating House of Cards. The only way
it would be rude, frankly.
You'd have to have had a Netflix subscription in the past so you couldn't get a free month. And then you'd have to decide, I'm not going to pay £6 for a month of Netflix to watch this show that obviously took millions of dollars to make. I'm going to steal it. And then you feel like a bad person. If you can justify to yourself, oh, I can't get this in this country, or it's not available right now, I want to talk about it on Reddit or Tumblr or whatever, people will do it because there's a kind of accessibility thing. People will do that.
And also the way they did Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
In the US, where they would get the episode pretty much as soon as they possibly could after it being broadcast in the States so people could watch it. Therefore, completely wiping out the point of pirating it. Because
I'm still
pirating it would be more hassle than...
Yeah,
and lower quality.
Watching it.
Well, I mean, I thought that there was a movement in TV, you know, kind of spanning a couple of years ago now, where it was trying to bring... you know, shows that were created, you know, in a global release. You know, so it'd be, if not the same day, at least, you know, kind of within the same week or so.
It's been brought forward by, you know, the whole piracy thing, because it is, you know, it's like when Morefour were showing The Daily Show.
Mm.
If I really wanted to watch The Daily Show, I could watch it hours before Morefour were going to put it on TV.
Hmm.
And probably easier.
I will happily admit that when I was sort of when in sort of 2007, when I was, I pirated The Daily Show every day, because the 3 days afterwards, when it would be on the global edition on Morefour, it wouldn't be funny anymore. It was a waste of time.
It would be so, that thing.
It would be that it would be dated, and I'd have seen half the clips of it on YouTube. But I wanted you needed to consume it, and the same with the shows like The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad. If you don't watch Game of Thrones in the 2 days after it's aired, it'll get spoiled for you in the metro or online on any of the on The Guardian anywhere.
I think essentially, organizations, companies like Sky, either A, shouldn't be allowed to have the exclusivity agreements that they do, or B, if they're gonna try and get stuff over other people, they should probably find some other offering to go alongside what they're offering in order to justify having it. Otherwise, there should be a way for people to get just a basic version of the content available through the service.
I basically think it's bollocks. The way that, you know, things like Netflix and the internet is changing things. This whole idea of a TV channel, you know, buying a TV series, you know, months after release and putting it up, is getting to the point where it must be unsustainable. I've wondered how much, you know, the piracy has hurt the viewing figures for The Walking Dead.
Mm.
Because it's so easy now to be able to watch these series. I mean, is The Walking Dead on Netflix UK?
No.
No. And not having it on an on-demand service like that as well, you fail to capitalize on new viewers whose friends are talking about The Walking Dead and they want to check it out. You're much more likely to go on Netflix and watch episode one of Breaking Bad than you are to buy season one of The Walking Dead on DVD because your friend says it was good. And I mean, loses you an audience.
I can only hope that The Walking Dead is going to be picked up by either another TV channel, free to air, which is, you know, my preferable approach to these things, or if it's going to be, you know, bought up by anyone exclusively, then let it be someone like Netflix or, you know, even Love Film.
The thing is that it is possible to have stuff out on multiple platforms. I believe Game of Thrones, well, we have moaned about it. It is available on a couple of platforms that aren't just Sky, because I think it's on iTunes, and I believe it's also on whatever Google's kind of multimedia sort of stories.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
The Game of Thrones producers, though, have expressed some really interesting attitudes towards piracy in terms of how flattering it is and how it just means they've got more of an audience. I think they've got a more kind of sort of multi-format approach to making money from the Game of Thrones franchise, which is that if tons of people are watching Game of Thrones, it will make money, you know, because people will pay to broadcast it and people will pay to buy things associated with the show and buy more of the books and buy tie-in things. And that seems to be working pretty well for them given its current success. But the Game of Thrones is easier to not exploit, but to make sort of associated incomes from, isn't it, than some TV shows.
There was something that occurred to me recently about all this kind of thing, and it's an interesting idea. As technology has, you know, become far more widespread, ironically, it's meant that things are less tributable by, you know, the individual. It's like, you know, if I was watching, The X-Files on its original run, I taped it off TV.
Mm.
And I gave the tape to friends, which, you know, it's technically a naughty thing to do, you know, from a loyally point of view.
Tut.
I know I'm worse than Hitler, but you know, things like that, you don't, I mean, I know you can get DVD recorders now, but how many people actually use those to, you know, record stuff off TV and then, you know, give them to friends?
Not very many.
No, not very many.
Minuscule amount. it's much more anonymized, isn't it? If you, I mean, why would you bother when you, again, you can go on the Pirate Bay and download it, and everyone knows you can. So
I can fiddle around with the DVD plus R, and I can do this and that, and I can make sure that the disc is finalized, otherwise it won't play. You know, all of that kind of thing. You know, which is a lot more of a fiddly pain in the ass than just slapping in a, you know, VHS tape and saying, you know, give us the tape back when you're finished with it because I want to record such and such at the weekend.
So your argument is we should all go back to VHS? Is that that the solution to piracy?
I'm kind of torn on that because I absolutely hated VHS. I hated the quality and I just hated everything about it and I could not wait. I was even almost an early adopter of VCD, as shit as that was.
Oof, because you dodged a bullet there, I think.
Yeah. I was thinking of forking out 150 quid for a bloody VCD decoder cartridge. Yeah.
Meanwhile, in similar Channel 5-related news, Richard Desmond, the guy who owns Channel 5, plus, you know, the newspapers like the Daily Star and Daily Express, and launched that lottery that nobody ever plays, is looking to sell his Channel 5
Which
portfolio.
Can only be a positive.
He's, what was it, he, apparently, during his watch, he's managed to return the channel to profitability, and he's looking for at least, I think, is it £700 million?
Good looking.
He's done all right out of that on a sort of personal, completely ignoring any kind of, you know, how well he did on a sort of critical level. I mean, he seems to have done quite well out of it by bringing Big Brother to that channel and getting rid of The Walking Dead.
And now I'm going to bring us to the saga of Candy and Saga and King, which is my attempt to come up with a title that rationalises the use of common nouns and game titles and legal issues, and oh my god, what the hell have King done? It's this can of worms that's just kind of exploded in their face. And it wasn't just any kind of exploding can of worms, it was kind of where the worms had been slightly heated, so it was kind of like this lava-like molten dribble that just kind of smeared all over their faces last week.
Can I just say, I really, really hope that they don't actually try and sue you for your surname.
I know. I mean, I'm pretty sure my birth certificate will prove that I'm older than them. Meanwhile, I'll team up with Stephen King, and I'm sure he will be on my side on this matter.
We will create a legion of King celebrities.
Yeah, I was planning to make a game about my life and call it the King Saga, such has been the epicness of my life. But you know,
someone should make that for the related game jam,
yes.
I think. Story about you, Emily King. Jam. That'd be great. Just a short game.
Yeah.
Well, the sequel, Saga of the King's Scrolls.
Yes.
And his candy.
And his candy. could somebody, for our listeners, try to explain what the hell it is that we're talking about?
Assholes copywriting simple bloody words and then trying to sue the arse off everyone who used them.
Yeah, I think it's the Candy Crush. The owners of Candy Crush Saga are trying to assert a copyright on the word. Is it Candy and Saga? They both claim are related to their work.
Trademark.
And
have,
I'm surprised they haven't tried to do Crush as well.
That's funny. But they use Saga in a lot of other games and are basically claiming that the word Saga in relation to games or game-related products is now theirs, which seems optimistic at best. Yeah.
Does anyone here remember Edge?
The magazine?
Of course. The Edge saga.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Where a bloke who did games back in, you know, the 80s, He owned a label called Edge, or, you know, The Edge. And he says he copyrighted the word Edge for games and then went around trying to sue anyone who used it. And apparently this bloke was an arsehole in the 80s and screwed people out of, you know, he bought their games and then, you know, checks bounced. Or, you know, further payments and royalties never turned up for them. But, yeah, he sued The Edge magazine, and you know, they coughed up. He tried suing various companies until he came and stuck with EA.
Did he sue you too?
That's a good question.
I'd love to find out if he tried to sue
probably
The Edge.
Because, yeah, I think their lawyers would have more money than God.
Oh, yeah, he'd be crushed.
And they'd work tax free. But, yeah, he... he came up against EA and finally came unstuck because he, well, let's see, it was, I think it was Mirror's Edge.
Was it the floppy disk incident, by the way? Or was that one of the many routes or rungs on the path to him finally stopping?
I think it was, yes.
Okay.
But various websites, including Eurogamer, have a good write-up of the Edge saga and the pure deliciousness of his downfall as he just got everything kicked out of court in the US. Oh, it was a beautiful thing because he was making a good living out of being a legalistic arsehole. And this is the same kind of thing. It's just, oh, you use a word in a game and the game becomes popular and suddenly you put a very dubious patent or copyright or
trademark.
On this, and you try and go after.
I mean, I get that there are Candy Crush Saga clones out there, but it was the fact that they went after the Stoic and the Banner Saga.
Well, their claim, and this is kind of partially couched in truth, but doesn't make it any less kind of frustrating, I think, is that, and this is kind of true of American copyright law particularly, is that you have to be seen to be defending your copyright and putting in queries about other people's uses of copyrights related to yours. So they kind of say that they don't actually have a problem with them using the word saga, but they need to be seen defending it so that later when a genuine impersonator comes up, they can say, look, we've been defending this copyright. This is a copyright we're continuing to hold up and use. That is kind of
it's a perverse nature of the law.
I'm not suggesting that they're behaving in a way that's beyond reproach, but that they're kind of caught in this weird legal system and responding to it in a particularly dubious way, given that they have a history of games which are certainly closely related, I will carefully say, to very similar games, including one of their earliest games, which is this Pack a Void game, which was one of the earliest games on King.com.
It's
kind of pretty shamelessly taken in a design sense from another company.
They do dodgy Photoshops and put a tash on. And this is our unique version.
King are very good at making taking existing ideas and making them incredibly addictive, basically. I mean, Candy Crush is very clearly about being addicted to sugar.
They copy other people's games.
Games in general, I mean, you're always building on other people's work.
It's a difficult
line to tread, and I'm trying to be diplomatic about the way
I don't care about being diplomatic. They rip people off, and
there was an article over Games Industry last week from an indie dev who says that King copied their game after they wouldn't sell up.
Yeah, they basically just went to another developer, didn't they, and said, we want a version of this.
The original developer is
because they pulled out.
The original developer is claiming as well, that they weren't told the kind of truth about who owned the original idea, and that the copycat developer who was hired second to make the game again was told that they'd kind of been backed out on. King had been backed out on a contract about the game, and that's why they were getting this kind of copycat version made, which then the original developers are claiming isn't true. So I don't know what exactly went on there, but it certainly seems to be a bit dubious. And for them to be involved in that kind of thing in some capacity and then going on to do this is obviously a poor contrast for them, which is why the internet is so aflame with rage.
I think this kind of thing happens a hell of a lot, especially in the smaller game communities. And it's just when something gets really popular and they get a bit of money behind them and they think, we've got something which is valuable, we'd best try and defend it as any way we can. And, partly because of their asshole behavior and partly because of, the amount of attention things are getting. I mean, not a week goes by without me getting a Candy Crush Saga invite or, whatever on Facebook or, something like that. So, I keep seeing it. I am aware of the game. I think I have it installed on my iPod, but I've never played.
I've written about Candy Crush Saga and how it kind of works. It's very clever in that what it essentially does is it starts off by rewarding you for being clever and then stops because you finish levels and you feel good because you were smart. And then slowly it kind of takes away the skill element and makes it about spending money and using items. But you still get the kick out of finishing a level because you were originally trained to think, this is pleasurable to beat the level. I feel smart. And some people get very, very addicted to that. I'm finishing a level. I must be clever. I'm good at this game. And don't notice that they've spent £5 to beat that level by buying upgrades. They just don't. People, there's a disconnect there, you know, between kind of why the skill needed to progress and then why it was originally pleasurable later, which is why people get really into that kind of mobile game, especially.
And I'm far too cynical for games like that. I just see it as, you know, if you're talking to someone, if you find, you know, someone's company nice and you're talking with them, and then if they suddenly halfway through a conversation says, I have to go unless you buy me a drink.
Hmm.
And you piss off then.
But you're aware, you catch me as someone who knows games and has understood games for a long time, and it seems to be the case that the people who go and play those games, and particularly the people who buy stuff on Candy Crush, aren't people who are kind of accustomed gamers. Because that's why those games are so much more popular on mobile. Candy Crush maybe is much playing on consoles.
Yes, they're sort of, you know, not gamers, but they game.
Yeah, it's an entertainment on the train for someone who doesn't play games very much, so they're maybe not quite so savvy. But the people who make those games are very design savvy. They know games very well, and they use their knowledge of games to make games that are fun for people who don't play games at all, which is why they're often kind of cliched or kind of copies of other ideas that we would all be aware, you know, have existed hundreds of times before. People who spend money on Candy Crush don't get that, and they just kind of get drawn into the experience.
Meanwhile, in relation to all of this, somebody's started a Candy Game Jam and is... that's still running this week. I think it ends either at the weekend or on Monday next week. So, candy-themed games.
Ooh, I like candy.
That kind of copyrighted music, of course, in a Game Jam game. That would be deeply troubling. You can't. There was a thing where, I don't know if I should point this out in case Boss will get in trouble, but you know that Surgeon Simulator game that Boss Studios made?
Mm.
That the original version of that just used the casualty theme in the Game Jam version, and they released it online and it got loads of attention, and then they subtly changed the music for the full release, which was kind of quietly done because you can't actually use the casualty theme. That would get you in trouble.
They could just say, actually, it's the causality.
It's a misspelling of the casualty theme.
Yeah.
Sure, one note is like half a tone up by accident.
Yeah, just occasionally, you know, get a MIDI of it and put a bum note in every 10 seconds or so. There you go, sounds legit.
That goes against the spirit of the Candy Game Jam in particular, I suspect.
I think I'm going to move us on to the final part of tonight's show, where we were going to ask Jack about video games in general and his PhD that he's doing whilst doing duties at Antimatter Games.
Duties, that makes it sound militaristic.
Yeah. Well, you know, you hush hush projects and all that kind of thing, you know, loose lips sink ships, you know.
Yeah, I've got to be careful. Yeah, that's very appropriate actually, given that we make sort of World War II stuff by and large at the moment.
Yeah.
loose lips sink ships. Yeah, no, we're doing secret things that I can't entirely discuss.
But you could tell us about your PhD thesis that you're starting work on, right?
Yeah, no, I can tell. That's not secret. If anything, I'm desperate to talk about that. It's quite a fun balance. I spend half my time working at Antimatter, where my job title is technically assistant producer, and then I spend the other half of the time, I'm an academic at Falmouth. I'm doing a PhD thesis on sort of textual analysis, or close reading, you might call it, of game texts. Which just means games. It's a fancy way of saying games. So it's quite a sort of fun balance. And I'm also involved in there's a new BA in games. I can plug that. Look at that. Look at me plugging that. There's a new BA in games in Falmouth starting up next September 2014, which is quite exciting. So I kind of followed the supervisor of my MA, which was also in games, down here to Falmouth. And there's kind of a big new game scene starting up here. There's lots of new things going on. It's quite exciting. It's a cool place to be for games at the moment.
Still remember when I did my final dissertation for my BA at Falmouth, and unfortunately I was landed with a supervisor who hadn't played a video game since Super Mario Bros. 2 and did not have much in the way of ideas about the representation of women in video games, which was pretty much what my dissertation was about.
What degree did you do, out of interest?
Pardon?
What degree did you do?
English with Media Studies.
So so sad, because, you know, I taught a class for the English and Media Studies course in January. Yeah. early January, and there's a games cultures module for that course now, which has woman teaching who knows more games than that.
I did a closer, the closest I got to that for unit was I'd had a cyber cultures unit that I did, and there was a games element to that at the time. So, but yeah, my dissertation was like the first dissertation at Falmouth that wasn't about games design. It was about the actual sort of like story and narrative and sort of cultural representations and stuff.
Yeah, games critique is kind of this nascent field that I'm kind of getting involved in. But the woman, the professor of games at Falmouth is a woman called Tanya Kruzwinska, who's sort of one of the earliest proponents of that kind of view. And she's written extensively about women in games, as you might imagine. So it's quite sort of fun department, but there's also a big practical element to it as well. We've got, I mean, the BA is sort of part theory, and then you specialize in a field. So there's kind of six strands, and one of those is design, another is writing, audio, art, animation, and programming. So we have a kind of spread of different disciplines all kind of joined with a theory critical appreciation strand, which is quite exciting, sort of right up my street. It's good.
Then you don't have to go into it in depth, but I assume you've read Killing is Harmless by Brandon.
Yeah, that was one of the major texts that kind of started me on this sort of trend. Certainly, there's some kind of works like that, but he's one of the only people who's written. I mean, it's an enormous. I don't even know what to call it. Is it a book? It kind of feels silly to call it an essay, given its length.
It's
an e-book, certainly, isn't it? Whether in a sort of academic sense you'd call it a whole book, I don't know. But
it's more than 50,000 words. So it's a book in its own right. Believe me.
My PhD is kind of inspired by the idea that most of the kind of existing really academic writing about games tends to be sort of surveys of the field. So people will talk about what games are or what games will be in the future. There's a really big book called Hamlet on the Holodeck, which kind of says it all in the title. I mean, it's not really about games as they currently exist. It's sort of, one day games will be amazing. And no one really, apart from Brendan Keogh and a couple of other people, really sit down and say, this specific game is doing these things, and sort of appreciate them in the same way you might. You might have a book on Yeats Shakespeare or a film or a filmmaker's work or a genre of film, but game studies tends to be more about sort of categorizing and labeling and giving names to things. And I'm quite keen to spend more time talking about how individual games work and why, and kind of being more kind of humanities about it, I guess, is my approach.
What got you interested in video games from what sort of age, really?
Oh, I've been playing games forever. I used to play games when I was really young. I used to play games and read books. That was basically my whole thing. And then I kind of always used to see them equally. One of my biggest bugbears growing up was when people would say that they wanted their children to play less games and read more books, because I thought the two were not kind of oppositional. They were kind of similar in my head. And then I went on to do, I did a BA in English. And sort of after I finished, when I was doing that, I remember I did an essay 1 week on, it was sort of dystopias. I was doing, you know, 1984 and that kind of thing. And at the same time, I was playing Bioshock for the first time. And I remember thinking that these two things are sort of the same. You could write an essay about Bioshock just as easily as you could write about 1984. And why do people do that for one but not the other? So then I kind of eventually went on to do an MA and then now the PhD and make games. That's kind of my journey. Yeah.
Okay. So you were saying that you wrote as an assistant producer at Antimatter.
Yeah.
So what's that involving for you at the moment?
Oh, well, in a sort of... sorts of things, really, because we made Rising Storm, which was this. It's a World War II sort of multiplayer, 64-person Japanese versus Americans multiplayer game. So we tend to have I tend to be spending my time coordinating various people who are doing things, because there tends to be there's a sort of level design position and an art and animation position and a programming position, and then someone needs to kind of stand in the middle and make sure everyone's on the same page and kind of coordinating all of them. So it kind of suits my approach to games in an academic sense, because what I'm often doing is making sure that different people's parts of a game work together. And often it's also, producing, especially for a game like that, is mostly about sort of communication, I think, and making sure people are working together, and just organizing them is kind of the base thing. It's quite a sort of challenging job, and particularly we've got an unusual structure because when the Rising Storm was made, everyone in the company worked remotely. They were kind of a mod team that had got together making mods for Red Orchestra 1. And then they kind of made an agreement with Tripwire, the people who make Red Orchestra, that they would make a kind of standalone expansion for Red Orchestra 2, and they'd kind of publish it. So when I started the company, almost all the employees were remote, and it was just kind of, we were just setting up a Cornwall office for the company just after Rising Storm had come out. And then over the course of the last 6 or 7 months, we've had sort of 12 people come to Cornwall to settle in a physical office and kind of start developing games. And we've got another, I would say, about 15 to 20, depending on kind of how often they work for us, kind of contractors at the moment, who are all members of the Rising Storm team for the most part. And they're kind of gradually also moving to Cornwall. Plus, we've taken on a couple of new people, usually people who are kind of involved in the games community. As modders and stuff, because that's kind of our origins. So a lot of it is kind of making sure that people in the office aren't stepping on the toes of people who are working remotely, or making sure that kind of projects have like an overarching idea, and that the people at Tripwire are okay with what we're doing with the kind of Red Orchestra franchise in general, and also then just kind of... and organizing big parties. That's what I do as well. We're having a big party to celebrate our Game of the Year award for Rising Storm pretty soon at 8-Bit Bar in Falmouth. Okay. Which is going to be lots of fun. So I've been organising all that.
Oh, that is pretty awesome. I mean, after the what you're working on but you can't talk about thing, what do you think in general the future for the company will hopefully have hold? Because, I mean, it's a unique kind of business to have in Cornwall, because I know of obviously like indie-level developers, you know, kind of like one-person bands in a bedroom who've like put stuff out on mobile mostly that do operate within sort of Cornwall and Devon, and then some of the larger companies that are definitely in Devon. But I have to say, you guys are probably the most ambitious I've heard.
Well, it's
operating down here.
We're in a really exciting position because there are no investors in the company. It's owned by people who worked on Rising Storm. Mm. And there was kind of, we're in a position where we're not kind of, but I mean, we work with other people at the moment. Obviously, Tripwire, who made the original Red Orchestra games, they're sort of our publisher. But we're not forced by that kind of corporate overstructure. So yeah, we've got quite a sort of big setup. We're sort of a mid-level developer now, rather than being an indie. But we don't have that. We're not quite so mm-hmm. beholden. So I think in the long run, we're looking to kind of make our own stuff of some description maybe someday. That's certainly kind of an exciting end goal. And also just kind of, yeah, working on kind of interesting projects and finding... Because, yeah, we all have skills. Everyone who worked on the Rising Storm team has kind of massive technical skills and obviously has worked on a kind of game that did pretty well. I'm quite happy saying that because I didn't work on it. they're all very talented folks. But we're also kind of figuring out being a games company and working in a physical location right now. And that's quite a sort of exciting time. We're kind of still figuring it out. And it's fun for me as well, kind of coming into that and having a sort of semi-academic perspective and kind of helping to sort of set that up and figure out how we work. Yeah, it's fun. Hopefully we'll kind of figure it out as we go. But I think it's been an exciting learning experience so far.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. So it's goodbye from...
Jack. And you can find Antimatter at @AMG_feed on Twitter.
It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and retroid.eurogamer.net.
And it's good night from me, Paul Blett, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blett.
And it's good night from me, Emma King. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891. You can find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can also find us on iTunes. We're on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. Plus, we're on Facebook and Google Plus as an Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com, where there's stuff, apparently. I keep editing things and making it live. I assume that's stuff. But, yeah.
I think that's stuff.
It's stuff. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.